Where warp meets weft.
Where warp meets weft.
This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Welcome to episode 33, Interweavings. This episode, we have the pleasure of chatting with Linda Ligon, the founder and creative director of Interweave Press. Interweave Press publishes a host of magazines, including Handwoven and Spinoff, as well as many excellent books on the fiber arts and weaving. We pay tribute to Peter Collingwood, and Callie Booker shares her weaverly adventures in the final essay, Fruit and Fiber. In past years, the Halloween episode of Weavecast has always contained a bit of wacky, spooky fun. This year, however, I find myself reflecting on the past and absent friends. Peter Collingwood, a much-respected weaver and author, passed away on October 9th of this year. I never had the pleasure of meeting Peter in person, so I can't tell you touching stories about how he said that one perfect thing to me in that workshop, or laugh about the time that hilarious thing happened in Copenhagen. For that, you'll have to read other people's posts on weaving lists and their blogs. I knew Peter the way so many did, through his books and his art. My first inkling that Peter was someone to take note of was when I was acting as scribe for the COE in 2006. Nearly every time the judge had to look up an exact definition or check a reference, they pulled out Peter Collingwood's The Techniques of Rug Weaving. So during the break, I ran over and opened up the copy and was flipping through it and was just stunned by the clear descriptions, the diagrams, and the encyclopedic nature of the book. It goes so much farther than simply rug weaving. Since then, I've also discovered his books on tablet weaving and ply splitting. Each one is a definitive work on the subject. I had the honor of interviewing Peter by telephone in May of this year. He was funny and gracious on the phone, very patient with all my questions, and took the time to really explain things. You can hear his interview on episode 31, Complicated Weavers. I never met Peter, but he still taught me a lot. I am grateful to him for sharing his research and knowledge with the world. A while back, Linda Hendrickson and her husband, John Brockway, had an opportunity to record Peter playing his dulcimer. With Jason Collingwood's permission, she's made those recordings available to Weavecast. The music isn't studio polished. There's the occasional mistake. But I think it's all the more lovely for that. It's like a skein of hand-spun yarn, or hand-woven fabric. The maker's hand is evident.
Thank you.
Our sponsor this episode is Shack Spindle Company. They are celebrating 40 years of creating wonderful spinning and weaving tools. After 40 years, they could rest on their laurels, but are they? No. They're continuing to innovate and bring out new products to make weaving easier and more fun. You can check out their new Cricut Loom online at www.shackedspindle.com. Last Thursday, I gave an hour-long presentation about Weavecast to the Seattle Weavers Guild. Normally, I don't think too much about the audience numbers for the show, but I knew one of the questions people would want answered is, how many people listen to Weavecast? It is not as easy to answer as you might think. The first chart I looked at was the number of people who have subscribed to the RSS feed. This chart shows steady growth over the last 2.5 years with a current level of about 1,500 subscribers. 1,500, I thought. Not bad. But I know from giving this talk before and surveying the audience that a lot of folks don't subscribe to the feed. They download the MP3 files manually. So next I looked at the download statistics for each file on the web server. The numbers varied from show to show, and they also increase over time because as new people find the show, they go back and catch up by listening to the older episodes. For example, when episode 1 was released, Weavecast only had 2 listeners. But at this point in time, episode 1 has now been downloaded over 3,000 times. And looking at the stats, some of the episodes are real standouts, getting over 10,000 downloads. The numbers vary from show to show, but overall, I would say that the audience for Weavecast is something between 4,000 and 5,000 listeners. Another exciting thing about the listenership is how international it is. When the show first started out, most of the listeners were in the US and Canada. Then it spread to Europe, Australia, New Zealand, places where English was the dominant language. But if you look at the cluster map now, you can see listeners in South America, Africa, India, China, Russia. Weavers on 6 continents listen to the show. And I think that's just amazing. It makes all the work worthwhile. Thank you for listening and being a part of Weavecast. I was in my car the other day listening to NPR when they had their fall fundraising pledge drive. I'm not a big fan of pledge drives, but listening to them talk about why it was important to support the shows that you enjoy made me think that I should talk to you a little bit. I have been very lucky in finding businesses that are willing to support Weavecast by buying sponsorships, and I really appreciate that help. But sponsorships only cover the base level costs of running the show. Things like server fees, archive supplies, phone charges for interviews. What helps Weavecast grow are your donations. Because donations are variable, I pay for the core Weavecast costs through sponsorships, which are easier to plan and predict. And I save donations for special projects that take Weavecast to the next level. For example, here are 2 of the projects I would really love to pursue, but I need funding for. A couple of people have suggested that I do panel discussions. I get several weavers together in a room, and I interview them, and we get that wonderful back and forth as they interact not only with me, but with each other. And I don't have the hardware to make that happen. The other thing I want to do is bring you Weavecast more often than once a month. And the way to do that is for me to bring in audio interns, people who will work for free editing the audio from interviews in exchange for me teaching them how to edit audio. But in order for me to bring in audio interns, I need a second copy of the software that I use to produce the show. So these are the kind of projects that I could use your help with. I know these are tough financial times. And if you're feeling the current financial crunch, please do not feel obligated to send anything. My heart goes out for folks who've been hit by the current troubles. If you're one of them, please accept Weavecast as the gift it is. But if you're in a good financial place and you really enjoy the show, please consider sharing some of your good fortune with Weavecast. Every penny of donations goes straight back into improving the show. Together, we can take it to the next level. We can add panel discussions. We can have more frequent episodes. These things are all possible. Let's make it happen. To pledge your support for the show, you can either make a PayPal payment to donate@weavecast.com, or you can send a check payable to Weavecast at P.O. Box 860, North Bend, that's two words, Washington, 98045. Next up, we have an interview with Linda Ligon, the founder and creative director of Interweave Press, which publishes some of the finest weaving books on the market, as well as handwoven and spin-off magazines. When I sat down to do this interview, I knew I'd be speaking with a publishing powerhouse, but I hadn't anticipated just how much fun it would be. Linda is what people from my part of the world call a hoot and a holler. I'm here in Seattle talking to Linda Ligon, the publisher behind Interweave Press.
Happy to be here.
Interweave Press publishes a lot of different types of craft publications. Which one did you start with?
The one I started with doesn't exist anymore. The first publication was just called Interweave. The initial impulse was that it would be a regional magazine for fiber craftsmen in the Mountain Plains states. It was a fun magazine. It started out being very multimedia. It fairly rapidly focused in hard on weaving and spinning. Then it got gobbled up by one of its sister publications.
One of the questions I typically ask is, how did you get started with weaving? Because weaving is an unusual profession, but it seems to me that publishing magazines on weaving is even more unusual. How did you get involved in that?
I was teaching high school English. This was in 1970. The first day I showed up on the job at Fort Collins High School, the principal said, "Oh, by the way, you get to sponsor the student publications," which meant a biweekly newspaper and an annual. And this was on top of my general teaching load. I didn't know how to do that. I didn't know anything about it. But during the 3.5 years I taught high school, the kids had so much fun. It became the highlight of my day to meet with my publication staffs. I would teach several composition classes, and I would try to pound it into these kids how to organize an essay, and they hated it. And then I'd go into the student publication classes, and kids who didn't particularly have any talent in a lot of cases were passionate about their writing because all their friends were going to read it. It was for the public. During the course of that 3.5 years, I not only caught the passion of that, but I also learned how to do a lot of practical things like how to work with a printer, how to get typeset, how to run a photography lab, the whole gamut of things that it took back in those days to create the publications, layout and paste up and typesetting. And
how did you make the jump from teaching to doing a craft magazine?
I got pregnant.
There's the secret.
There's the secret. my intention was to have the baby and then go back and teach. The reality was he was born with some considerable birth trauma, and I had to resign. During his early months, because he had been so ill, he slept a lot. He slept like 18 hours a day. I had a lot of loose time, and I'm not good at being a stay-at-home housewife mother. I knew I really needed to develop something to do with myself that I could do at home while I took care of him. By then, I had learned to weave. I had learned to weave early in my teaching career because it was just a sanity maker.
How did you learn to weave?
There was a woman in my little town in Loveland who started teaching weaving lessons. She taught them in a chicken coop on little looms that she had built herself by hand, little floor looms that she had built using back door screen springs. And I think she got the pattern out of the last Whole Earth catalog. I thought, well, wouldn't that be fun to learn? So I went and took classes with her, and I just loved it. It was the most fun thing I'd ever done. I just became obsessive about it as a spare time thing. So when I found myself not teaching with this real interest in weaving, and it was at a time when crafts were really in a growth mode, people in Colorado and Wyoming and New Mexico and Arizona, you know, in the western half of the United States, did not have any print media. It was the tail end of Hand Weaver and Craftsman. It was on its very last legs. There was Shuttle, Spindle, and Dyepot, which was a great magazine, but it was very Eastern-focused. Most of the print media was focused on the East Coast. So I thought it would be fun and diverting to create a publication for fiber crafts people in the West. And that was the idea. So that's what I did.
And when you started your magazine, did you imagine that it would grow into what?
Oh, God, no. No. What I imagined was that it would keep me out of mischief around the house until Day was old enough to go to preschool, and then I'd go back and teach. That's not what happened. What happened was I got totally absorbed. It was so much fun. It was the same kinds of things you're finding with your work. You meet interesting people. You have a chance to help people share their knowledge, their inspirations, their interests. You have a chance to connect community. And it was just endlessly fascinating. And the cool thing about magazines is you're always reinventing, and you're doing it on deadline. So you have to. I mean, you cannot slack when you're publishing a magazine. I mean, you always have the next chance to make it better or to try the next interesting thing. I mean, there's no end to the growth you can experience personally. I just never looked back.
What surprises have you had along the way?
How Handwoven came to subsume its predecessor, Interweave Magazine. This was 1978. Interweave was a good little magazine. It had a modest audience. I wasn't paying myself yet. I was able to pay a couple of staff people and get the magazine out. So it was healthy, but it wasn't thriving. It was a fairly serious magazine. It tended to do profiles of people, a lot of articles about technique. I was approached by several people on the manufacturing side who said, the knitters have magazines with projects in them with how-to step-by-step instruction, and there's nothing like that for weavers. They said, we really think there's an opportunity. And I thought about it. The fact was, weavers tended to turn up their nose at project instructions, the idea of being told how to make something. It was like everyone had to be creative and everybody had to figure it out for herself. And the idea of just doing something by rote was considered a little tacky. But I took a chance on it, developed an idea that I felt pretty good about, and published the first issue of Handwoven in 1979. At that point, Interweave, the magazine, had a circulation of about 6,000. I printed 10,000 copies of Handwoven, and within a month I had to go back on press for another 10. It just went through the roof. That happened about the same time my husband came home from work and said, by the way, I've quit my job. And so what had been almost a hobby business suddenly became a pay the mortgage, buy the groceries, and get ready to put these kids through college business. I got hate mail over Handwoven. It didn't make me cry, but it made me feel really bad.
What were they complaining about?
That it was not right to tell people how to make stuff, that it was tacky, that it demeaned the craft. And yet, it was outselling its sister magazine 3-1 in every regard. It was interesting.
It was kind of like bodice rippers. Nobody wants to admit that they read
exactly.
them, but they sell.
Yeah, exactly. To the credit of the weaving community, weavers are more inventive and more independent in their work than most other fiber crafts people. I mean, more than knitters, for instance, and certainly more than crocheters. But they seem to love reading the particulars of how a thing was made. It would give them ideas. It would give them understanding of how certain yarns behave at particular sets and with various threadings without having to actually sample till their arm fell off. A lot of people used the instructions to replicate, and far more used the instructions to learn. That was a surprise, and that really turned the corner for Interweave, the publishing company, because suddenly it was a serious business. It was a business that was showing signs of success. I was pulling a salary because I had to. It just took it to another level.
When your husband came home and said he'd quit his day job, what did you change about how you approached the magazine?
I began to make decisions on the basis of whether they would pay back. I began to run the business as a financial enterprise. And that meant making decisions that didn't particularly suit me personally in some cases. I mean, I liked Interweave, the magazine. I liked it a lot. But that was not going to support the business or support my family or support my employees. In the mid-80s, when the craft market began to decline, I couldn't afford for my business to decline, and so I started thinking about how to diversify. So I was trying to think, well, you know, I've got Handwoven, that's doing well. We're publishing some books, those are doing okay. We're starting to get a little bit into knitting books, and that seems to be really good. And, well, we were doing spinoff, too, which the first issue of that came out in 1977, so it had been around a while. But I could see that there could potentially be problems. So I thought, what other kind of magazine would I like to publish that there is a market for, that there's not competition for? Some years earlier, I had run across a little magazine called The Herb Quarterly. It was being published out of Vermont by a woman. Same kind of thing I was doing, publishing out of her home. It was a really nice little magazine. I walked into the health food store down the street from my office to pick up a sandwich, and I saw a copy of the Herb Quarterly sitting on the rack. And as I stood there and looked at it, I thought, I should buy that magazine. This thought came into my mind, she wants to sell this. So I went back to the office and dropped her a note and said, saw your magazine at the local store. It looks really good. And a couple of weeks later, I got a letter from her saying, well, funny that you should write because I want to sell it and I think you should buy it.
What a funny coincidence.
You guys
totally. On the same wavelength.
Well, at that point we were. So we started into negotiations. She wanted an absurd amount of money for it. I mean, just ridiculous. But I went as far as I could to meet her price. We had a deal going. It took us months and months and months. And then she hired a New York lawyer with a sharky reputation to look over the contract. And he basically persuaded her that I was ripping her off. Well, by that time, I was so far down the road, I was ready to go into production on it. And I said, well, you know, I'm really sorry. We're not going to be able to do this deal, but I need you to know I'm going to proceed on my own. So I redesigned and renamed and came up with my own version called The Herb Companion. That was 1988. And that turned out to be a very, very successful, fun magazine.
At what point did you start doing books?
We did our first book in 1980. I'd started Spinoff Magazine in 1977, and it was an annual at that point. It was just once a year. I was becoming aware that there was a solid spinning community that wasn't being served. I ran across a little book. I think actually the woman who was editing Spinoff, Ann Bliss, at that time, brought it to my attention. A little book being published in New Zealand called Fleece in Your Hands. It was just a little pamphlet kind of thing, but rock solid good information. I had these several thousand Spinoff readers, and I thought, well, give them something else that'll be good for them, that they'll like and find useful. So I got rights to that book and redesigned it, re-edited it, re-photographed it, and that was our first book. It did quite well. Given that we had no distribution outside of advertising in our own magazines and going into weaving shops, we sold several thousand copies. That was really the guiding business principle. If you have an audience of people who are passionate about a subject and there are not a lot of supply chains feeding their interest, well, just give them more. It's really vertical marketing that helped the business grow.
The name of the magazine, Spinoff, was it named that because it was a spinoff?
Okay, I'll tell it. Yes. The short answer is yes. The long answer is I was visiting, this is early, early days, this is probably 1976, I was down in Fort Worth, Texas. There was a wonderful spinner whose name you may know, Art Ronan. An elderly, retired military gentleman who, for some reason, had just seized on spinning as the most interesting thing in the world. And he had started a spinning guild down in Fort Worth, and it was Colonel Ronan and his spinners. I was down there interviewing him. I was at his house, and I needed to take a potty break. So I went in the bathroom, and there was a little basket by the toilet with all of the newsletters for his spinning group. I picked one up and started flipping through it, and I thought, my gosh, these spinners down here in Fort Worth are so lucky. They have this great, informative, fun, community-building newsletter. And I thought, there are spinners all over the country who need that. I thought, well, I can do that. I can help them out. And that was it. But yeah, Spinoff, it was a pun.
It's amazing to me how many years I read that magazine before one day I looked at it and went, hey. What advice would you give a writer who's interested in writing for Interweave Press?
You mean a book author?
Yeah.
Look at what Interweave does and let that be your guide. I can't tell you the number of book proposals I used to get that were so inappropriate, so outside our subject matter, and the pitch always was, this isn't like anything else you publish, so you should publish it. If people want to write a book and have Interweave publish it, they need to know what we do well. They need to be aligned with that. They need to have freshness and originality, and they need to be willing to get out there and promote their own book. Because that's the key to success. I mean, that's the key to a book really doing well. And we help people do that. We work really hard to help our authors succeed with their titles.
In the fiction world, a lot of publishers are actually using agents as their first tier of editing, in that they will not accept unagented manuscripts. Does Interweave Press accept unagented manuscripts?
We rarely accept an agented manuscript, and we rarely need to. Our editorial staff knows the subject matter better than almost anybody else in the world. and has the capacity to recognize what's good, to help shape a book in the best way, to help bring the best out of the author. We know who the talent is because we get to know them through our magazines. So we don't need agents, and all agents do is take part of the author's money. So
how is that good?
It's been interesting in the knitting world the last few years because knitting is so hot and knitting books are so hot. Interweave is in the practice, has been for years, of giving modest advances, maybe $2,000, $3,000, $5,000 typically, sometimes more, but rarely. Some of the New York publishing houses have jumped on the popularity of knitting. So now we're competing with Random House, you know, you name it. And those are more agency-driven publishing houses. And we have agents who are pushing for $50,000 advances. It's not a good business model, and we don't do that. We're having to compete in a whole different way.
I want to go back to you talking about your editorial staff. Interweave Press books tend to be really high quality, both in terms of the pictures and the content. How did you develop such a strong editorial staff?
In the beginning, it was totally homegrown and self-taught. Those of us who published those early books, that first little book, I did it myself. I'd never published a book before, so it was learning by doing. Then as the years went by, mostly our magazine editors edited our books as well. It was something they did in addition to their core job. We just all learned it together. And we learned it by looking at good books and then emulating what made those good. And we didn't just look at weaving books or spinning books or knitting books. We looked at all kinds of good books in various enthusiast markets. We thought hard about what made an excellent book, and then we just emulated it. That was then. Now we have a highly professional book editorial team, editors who've come out of big New York houses with pretty high-level training. But they all have the passion. They have the subject matter knowledge.
A few years ago, you sold Interweave Press to Aspire Media. What was your goal when you did that? And have things worked out the way you hoped they would?
My goal was to get out before I got feeble. I was in my early 60s, and while I feel like I can keep working, I'll be there for years, I'm sure. I wanted to make the decision about who would take the company forward while I was in a position of strength and clarity. I made the decision with my executive team to put the business on the market, and we spent a couple of 3 years preparing it for that. My goal was to find ownership that would not mess it up the way I'd seen some other companies messed up.
And what were you afraid of?
I was afraid for my people. I had 70 or 80 employees that had invested their lives in the company, and I didn't want to see them given pink slips. That was one thing. I didn't want our smaller magazines, those being the weaving, spinning, needlework, those are little magazines in the overall scheme of publishing. I didn't want to see them put aside. I wanted to find a buyer who would recognize the business value they brought. So those were the things, to keep the product line intact and to keep the staff employed.
And have things worked out the way you hoped?
Things have worked out very differently in some regards, but the product line is intact. There's great support for the smaller niche magazines. The staff is largely intact, and it has tripled in size. The company has almost tripled in size. Those were the parts I didn't expect with such rapid growth. That's been really interesting. The CEO, Clay Hall, who is the head of Aspire Media, is a really smart man. He has grown the business in a really coherent way. There are a lot of companies in the publishing world today that are going out and buying up companies like Interweave using private equity money. And they buy them up like they were at the local flea market. Oh, I'll take this and then I'll have that. They create kind of a hodgepodge that only has value if they turn around and sell it really quickly. That's not Clay's model at all. I mean, he's building a really solid business.
I've seen new things come out like the Knitting Daily and the Beading Daily, and now Interweave Press is getting involved with television.
Yeah.
Which is pretty exciting.
We are. We've acquired some other companies. We acquired Quilting Arts, which was something I had lusted after for years. I just think it's such a great company and such great magazines. We acquired a bunch of beading and jewelry making titles from Prime Media. You know, it all fits. It's all craft. It's all enthusiast, creative subject matter. It's a company that I would never have envisioned, that I would not have the competency to run, but it's really interesting being part of it.
What's been the most rewarding part for you in your career of craft publishing?
It's hard to pick out a thing. I'm very proud of the publications that Interweave has done. I'm very, very proud of that. I'm proud of the quality and the stature that our products have in the publishing and in the craft community. And the people. You just make friends. You meet people. And you have the opportunity to work with such marvelous creative people. It's the making stuff and it's the working with the people to do it. It's been very, very satisfying.
Is there anything you would have done differently?
Oh, yeah. I'm not going to tell.
Fair enough. What's next for you in Interweave?
What's next for me and what's next for Interweave are not necessarily the same thing. I'm thinking I'm going to start working 4 days a week instead of five and use that extra day to learn new things. I want to learn Spanish. I want to learn InDesign. I want to learn to do graphics work. I want to spend more time with my grandkids. They're scattered all over the place, so it takes travel. But I still find probably my greatest satisfaction going to work at Interweave every day.
Thank you for taking the time to sit down and talk to us. It's been delightful.
It's been fun.
Next up, our audio essay is a perfectly fall-themed tale of weaverly adventure from the delightful Callie Booker. She blogs online at To Catch. Before we play this, I'd like to encourage more listeners to send in audio essays. As much as you enjoy hearing my tales from the loom, I enjoy hearing yours.
It's the beginning of September, and I'm sitting at the computer a few days before my rather late summer vacation. My husband and I are about to fly from Scotland to California, where my father has lived for the last several years. Stuart and I have a simple but thoroughly decadent plan: to spend 3 weekends with my father and stepmother near San Francisco, and the 2 intervening weeks travelling independently. And what does independent travel mean? It means textile travel, of course. What else could it mean? Well, to Stuart, it means wine tasting. So here I am online, looking for the perfect textile destination within spitting distance of Sonoma in September. Incredibly, I find it. To my astonished delight, I discover the perfect treat. The 11th annual California Wool and Fiber Festival will be taking place right in the middle of our visit, starting on Friday, 12 September. It's in Boonville. Where's Boonville? Please, please be near. I'm clicking from page to page, looking for a map. And there it is, just north of Sonoma, in Mendocino County. That must be near, mustn't it? California is an old friend of mine, but the scale of this state still boggles my mind. It looks near enough. Only the next county. And I start preparing my case, the case that will convince Stuart that more than anything, he wants to leave the vines and drive 3 hours north to spend a day watching me shop for yarn. When I broach the subject, he doesn't leap for joy, but he doesn't run away screaming either. Instead, I get a look, something which I trust is not exclusive to me, but imagine many weavers get from their non-weaving partners, their family, and perhaps a few very good friends. This look is not unfriendly, but it says, "Are you sure this is what you want to do? Are you certain that this trip, this project, this purchase, is really worth the time and trouble? Or are you just trying to drag me down with you?" I get a look, but I know what to offer. There's a charming little hotel just yards from the venue, and there are sheep. You know how you like sheep. I find myself surprisingly often offering the presence of sheep as an inducement. And then, on the day, I have to make good my promise. Standing on many a show threshold, I've heard a voice muttering in my ear, "So where are these sheep, then?" But we'll deal with the livestock issue when we get there. First, there is a hotel reservation to make. Great news! The charming little hotel has one room left for the Thursday night. Not so great news. It's the most expensive room in the house. We are committing ourselves to a $300 room on the chance of seeing a few sheep, for goodness sake, an animal which is hardly in short supply at home in Scotland. But at last, we're on our way, and it's the yarn which is drawing me on. I am sustained by the tantalizing and unfamiliar prospect of buying by touch and not mail order. It's yarn that I'm dreaming about as we leave Santa Rosa on the 101. Quite literally dreaming, since being a car passenger invariably sends me to sleep. I wake up when Stuart stops the car at the side of the road. A weary voice says, "We're there. I drove through the town and I saw the fairground, but I couldn't see the hotel." He turns the car round and we drive slowly back. I'm looking anxiously out of the window, but there it is, behind the trees, and as charming as anticipated. Thank goodness. And as Stuart turns the car again, I see the banner strung across the street, and I let out a delighted yelp. "Look, the show!" It says, "The Mendocino County Fair and..." I falter. "And apple show." Apple show. That is even worse than sheep. 1,000 times worse than sheep. What on earth have I done? And what should I do now? What I should do is walk up to the office and ask, "Is this the venue for the California Wool and Fibre Festival?" But I don't. We check into the hotel, and I don't ask. The room is delightful, and I don't ask. Dinner is a fabulous paella served on the terrace, and I still don't ask. Then at breakfast, over homemade scones and jam, I get another look. At least I think I do. It might just be an expression of pity, related to my over-tipping the teapot and getting the lid firmly wedged in my mug of tea. So, somewhat warm and damp from the Earl Grey splashed over my T-shirt, I get the bags together while Stuart checks us back out of the hotel. Neither of us has asked. We stroll nonchalantly down the street, affecting the air of worldly apple connoisseurs. At the fairground, the ticket booth has a list of prices on display. "They do a student discount," I say brightly. "We can save a dollar on admission." Well, that does make the trip worthwhile. The lady in the booth hands over a program, and I scan the text to learn my fate. And there it is, right underneath the floriculture and the boar goats, in bold type no less, "The California Wool and Fibre Festival is in the commercial building." Oh, hallelujah. And yes, there were sheep. Of course, there were apples, too, and in glorious abundance. Arrayed the whole length of one hall, in rectangles of 8 boxes by 5 against a painted yellow stand, they look like double cloth blocks just waiting to be woven. And the yarn shopping? I'm admitting nothing. You'll have to ask the assistant who found me the next week in Macy's, measuring up the 35-inch duffel bags.
If you like Callie's essay as much as I do, please drop a comment in the show notes and let her know. It's how we entice guest essayists to record for us again. Shh. That's all for this episode. And now it's time to get warped, because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave. Weavecast is made possible by donations from listeners just like you. This episode, I'd like to thank Nancy in Pennsylvania and Kathleen from Chicago, who credits Weavecast with calming her road rage. Now, I've driven in Chicago, so I know what a compliment that is. Our sponsor this episode is Schacht Spindle Company, celebrating 40 years of creating wonderful tools for spinners and weavers. You can find Schacht online at www.schachtspindle.com. Our musical guest this episode was Peter Collingwood. His dulcimer music was recorded by Linda Hendrickson and John Brockway, and used with permission by Jason Collingwood. Thank you.